The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
All right. Janelle Riley, welcome back to the Cinematography Podcast. Back. This is like, what, four, five?
At least.
I think it's at least four. Yeah. I think it might be five.
Back, but for the first time on camera.
Woo, yeah, that was a big surprise. Sorry, we didn't.
That's okay. Yeah. I was clearly dressed for television, so, yeah.
You came prepared.
I did, yeah.
You got your Martin Scorsese shirt on.
Yeah. The Marvel logo, which is... Oh,
yeah. And you've got googly eyes.
All my stuff has googly eyes on it. I was doing it before Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Were you?
Before it was cool. Yeah, you should know these things.
I don't.
No, I've always been. Remember, I used to have a googly eyes app.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Anyway. Yeah, I'm so cool. I don't know if you've let your listeners know that you have someone here who goes to game board conventions and puts googly eyes on things and is just generally really fucking cool.
I'll also add that if you ever are playing Simpsons trivia, you want Janelle on your team. God. Janelle has got to be on your team.
First 13 seasons only, really. Yeah.
Anyway, for people who haven't heard our Oscar roundup over the last, 4 years, Janelle, you're an editor at Variety. And if you live in LA, you moderate all of the big Q&As with all of the people that we're about to talk to, usually the directors and the stars. But we're here to talk about the Oscar nomination, specifically cinematography.
Yes.
And we're super excited here at our podcast because we actually got to talk to four of the five nominees.
And I'm super excited because I finally get to talk to about the categories that no one cares.
Wait a minute.
I'm kidding. Actually, no, it's. I was saying this, I just got back from Mexico, and people were asking me like sort of what I do and who I know, and you know, and they were talking a lot about Mexican cinema and, you know, or Spanish language movies. And I dropped some names of people like Diego Luna or Gael García Bernal, and they all wanted to know if I knew Chivo Lubezki. And I was like, not only do I know him, I can tell you that one time I did a Q&A with him and he had groupies. That came out to Malibu and we're like, Chivo!
We've been trying to get him on the show forever.
He's the sweetest man. The sweetest man. That was before he'd won a single Oscar. That was for Gravity.
Pretty
amazing.
And then
boom, 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 triple crown, three in a row. And I remember I remember the guy who gave me my computer at the Apple store was talking about how they get a lot of celebrities at their Apple store. And they were like, yeah, but the only one I freaked out was, you know, Emmanuel Lubezki. And I was like... This guy is like, people love him.
I get it. I would geek out if I saw him.
So I'm so bored of talking about actors and directors and happy to talk about the people who make those people look good.
And I actually mentioned it on the podcast when you invited me a few months ago to the, you did a Q&A with everyone from Oppenheimer except Christopher Nolan. He was there to introduce it.
So random, yeah.
He like showed up to introduce it and then he left and it was
he's still there. But
he wasn't part of the Q&A. So, you know, the only one who wasn't there was Hoyte van Hoytema.
Yes.
And I was going to go anyway, but I was like hoping to see him so I could talk him into coming on the podcast. He came on anyway.
He was supposed to go. Something happened. So he ended up not being there, but I was able to catch up with him like a week later.
But like, I was blown away because I don't think I'd been to one of your Q&As since before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And you had, you know, it was like 13 people
it's
up
crazy.
There. And you had... an amazing, meaningful question or two for each of them, and you knew all their names. And it was like the smoothest operation.
She's a pro. Of course.
I know.
That was
done
a big
this
one, though,
once
I
or twice.
I know, but it's like, you know, like when you're friends with someone, you just assume all your friends are fuck ups like you and me. But
thanks.
You know, but no,
yeah,
like
that's true.
I keep telling you I'm really cool. Did I mention board game conventions?
All right. So ostensibly though, the whole reason that we are sitting down here right now is to talk about the Oscars. The Oscars are coming up here, especially how it relates to cinematography. Last night was the ASC Awards. You know, I got to say, one of the coolest moments of the awards, I streamed some of this, was Spike Lee receiving a special President's Lifetime Award, which is super awesome. And the first thing he does is come out and basically says, you know, we got to thank the cinematographers because... And I'm paraphrasing, but he basically says, without them, we're shit.
Yeah.
So it's like...
so true. And you look like shit without them.
Yeah.
Be nice to the cinematographers. Just be nice to people in general, but be nice to the cinematographers, the editors. Ooh, they can save your ass in an editing room. Like, honestly, everyone on a set. It really does take a village.
Yeah. don't make fun of the costumer. You're going to end up with pants too tight. Don't make fun
of as a former makeup artist. Don't make
right?
fun. Don't piss
hair
off the makeup,
and makeup
artist.
People. Like, yeah.
These people are there to make you look good. Yep. You want them to be your friend.
They're your collaborators. They really are. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the Oscars. We got a couple of different categories here, but cinematography in particular is the one that we always, you know, spend the most time on. Are you leaning a certain way? Do you have a feeling
yeah,
about this?
I've fallen over. Oh, okay. Yes. I've leaned so hard. It's obviously going to be Hoyta for Oppenheimer, and I'm thrilled, honestly. I mean, this lineup is crazy. It's five legends who, none of them have ever won, 14 combined nominations between the five of them. It's insane. Like, honestly, I would be happy with any of these, but there's not going to be any surprises. It is Hoyta. Everyone's cool with that. Like,
I just want to say that last year we all sat on Zoom and we were like, Mandy Walker is obviously going to win.
That's true. We did.
Like, she'd won the ASC award. It would be historical. She would have been the first woman ever to win Best Cinematographer. And then All Quiet on the Western Front.
Really, well, the year of Mank. Yeah. Although I was actually had a really strong feeling Mank would win cinematography. But, you know, couldn't call it as a professional because all the signs pointed to something else. Oh, Nomadland, probably.
Yeah, so I feel like a lot of times all the signs point in one direction, including, again, last year, Mandy Walker. I assumed she had it in the bag, and deservedly so. Yeah.
And we were wrong.
Yeah, and it's not that All Quiet on the Western Front didn't look amazing. All of them are amazing, you know, I mean.
But she also wasn't part of the juggernaut of a movie. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a movie that ended up winning no Oscars, ultimately. But it was mostly just pegged for maybe costumes and Austin Butler for lead actor. Like, yeah. Oppenheimer is like, it's not a question of if, it's how many.
I agree, but like, how many times have we gone into an Oscar telecast being like,
we don't learn. What is the definition of insanity?
Such and such is going to sweep, and then it doesn't. And, you know, like, you know, we talked to Ed Lockman on the show, but like, when El Conde was nominated, we were like, what's El Conde? Because they really hadn't done a press push in America for it. And then I watch
it.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. His work in it is just like stellar knockout work.
You know, we got to talk about Matty LeBatique too, because, you know, Maestro didn't resonate with all audiences, but that movie is so freaking gorgeous. It is gorgeous. And there's so many, they were working on that movie for years, long before cameras ever rolled.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'd love to see Maddie win. I'd love to see him get it.
Also, so overdue. And when you look at Maestro, I really think about how that is, it's such a work of art. They all are, but in a very specific way where, like, even if people, you know, the movie didn't speak to them, you have to admire the direction and the cinematography and everything about that movie. It's so beautiful and different than really anything else. They're all pretty different, actually.
Speaking of different, we got to talk about Robbie Ryan and Poor Things. Poor Things is one of the most different movies I've ever seen.
I love that movie. I love everything about it. And I thought the cinematography was just stunning.
Yeah, no. So I loved his work on The Favorite as well. Yeah. It's interesting because I love Yorgos Lanthimos. And Poor Things is a really good movie. Yeah. But in the scheme of things, it might be my least favorite.
Oh, really?
I know, I know. And that's, by the way, that's like saying my least favorite Coen Brothers movie. Like, they're all great, you know, but it's interesting to me how people, like, this is a movie I thought would be a lot more divisive, and the fact that it isn't is tickling me.
That's so funny, because I walked into, we actually saw it together, Ilya and I, at a screening room on the Fox lot, and I kind of had, I don't know what my expectations were. Like, I was afraid it was going to be pretentious or whatever, and I mean, you could call it that, but I was just with it the whole way, and I loved that I had no freaking idea where it was going, and I feel like that ripples through to the cinematography. Like, I'm watching it, and I'm like, I've never seen a movie that looks like this. I've seen people like Terry Gilliam or Guillermo del Toro or, you know, Kubrick. They're like slices of different filmmakers that have done stuff in this realm, but like, it was just such a striking, original looking movie. And I know a lot of that is Yorgos Lanthimos, but also Robbie Ryan, you know, doing some amazing, amazing stuff in that.
When I saw that movie, I was convinced that your front runner for Best Supporting Actor would be Willem Dafoe, and he didn't even ultimately get nominated.
He's so great.
He's, for me, I mean, like, everyone's great in it. I actually
Mark
really
Ruffalo is also great in that movie.
No, Rami Youssef is great. His first movie. But I remember seeing that and thinking, like, that is your clear and away front runner. I mean, the guy's put in the work. He's a legend, and that performance is so tricky. He could have come off creepy, you know. Yeah. He could. There's so many things that could have gone wrong, and the fact that he wasn't even nominated is so befuddling to me. Because people obviously love the movie.
Yeah.
I think he's a big part of that too, because he's sort of the soul and moral compass for parts of that movie too, where it's like he looks like a monster, but he's not a monster.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for anyone who's watching this who hasn't seen the movie, but
yeah, but come on.
Yeah. You've had time now. You can go see Poor Things.
Yeah.
All right. So what else? So we've talked about Maestro. We talked about Poor Things. We talked
Killers
about Oppenheimer.
Of the Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon. So.
Epic. Just epic. And I watched some YouTube video that was explaining the breakdown of all the looks that they had created for that movie and how they had gone about like creating these custom lookup tables for the cameras to emulate three-strip Technicolor here and, you know, all this other stuff. And I mean, like, such a meticulously made film, which is what we expect from Martin Scorsese, as seen on your shirt. I mean, it really is a beautiful, wonderful film. And Rodrigo Prieto, despite not coming on our show this year,
he's a little busy. I mean, he's
directing something.
Barbie last year.
Well, yeah. I mean, I actually feel like that's one of the interesting things about it is, like, I wondered before the nominations came out if he would cancel himself out because he shot two of the biggest movies of the year. He shot Killers of the Flower Moon and Barbie. And in a way, like, Killers of the Flower Moon is gorgeous and wonderful and beautiful and awesome, but Barbie is such a distinctive and different looking film than anything I've ever seen him do. But also, like, I've just never seen a film that had that exact palette. You know, it's such an interesting looking
There's
film.
There's still that comedy bias, though, to some extent. Yeah. Like, it's not seen as important as Killers of the Flower Moon.
Well, and do you think that part of the bias, too, I mean, obviously this didn't seem to go through with Oppenheimer, but do you think some of the bias is that when something is that popular...
They had a lot of money to make it.
Yeah.
Although I don't actually think that does weigh into it. I think that's something people kind of throw out. Like, I mean, one of the things I love about El Conde and Poor Things is that they actually made these incredible looking movies on a budget.
Yeah.
So there's some consideration for that. But at the end of the day, it's like, no, I mean, obviously Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon belong there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I feel like Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon are both made to some degree to be Oscar movies. And I feel like Barbie was made to be a popular movie.
That's what people who like get upset about snubs or anything like that. It's like, do you understand what an accomplishment it is that Barbie got 8 Oscar nominations?
Yeah.
That's huge. Like nobody, I went to the premiere of that movie and walking out of it, I felt bad talking about how great Ryan Gosling was, because I was like, I'm doing, you know, what the movie says not to, which is I'm picking out the one guy.
But he's great.
He's so good. And like, so I was like, okay, Ryan Gosling could get nominated for this, but even then it seemed kind of crazy because it was a big summer comedy. And so to be here months later and, you know, have people be like, why was it overlooked in this category? I'm like, do you realize what it is? A win just that it did so well.
Yeah.
You know, and people are like, it might only take home one Oscar for song. I'm like, one Oscar is not bad.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I feel like there's a joke in there between like Barbie and 3-6 Mafia. I can't find it at this moment.
Oh, but
it's
like, yes. Yeah. 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 3-6 Mafia have the same amount of Oscars as Martin Scorsese. So
exactly right.
For a time, they had more than him. More. Yes, exactly. That's right. I think John Stewart pointed that out when they won. Yes. Martin Scorsese, 0.
Well, and that's the thing about Martin Scorsese is I feel like you kind of just want to say, give him all the Oscars because he's such a treasure and he's still making movies, you know, and he's still making movies at the top of his game. And I feel like the thing about Killers of the Flower Moon, as awesome as it is, like it just didn't rise in the level of the zeitgeistiness. And how much does that play into whether something gets
a nomination? I mean, that's everything. But also it's like, because like before the movie even came out, it feels like he was assured the nomination.
Yeah.
But I actually think, like, I really like Killers of the Flower Moon, and I'm trying to think back, like, the last movie of his that I liked this much. I mean, I like them all, but, I mean, I'm one of those weirdos who really loved Silence, so I don't know. Mm. But, like, I really like Killers of the Flower Moon, and I saw it, and I feel like we're taking, as much as he, like, you know, gets this automatic pass, we also take him and his collaborators for granted.
Agreed.
Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, there was a point where I thought he could have won. Now, there was, you know, campaigning, sometimes things happened there where I was like, oh, he's probably going to miss out on the nomination. But if you were just going off that performance, like, I was like, more people should be talking about this. And it's because it's Leonardo DiCaprio. We're like, of course he's great.
So when we get into this stuff, and this is what I really don't understand when we get to the cinematography piece of it, because the last 30 years have been about Oscar campaigning. Yeah. You know, the Weinsteins notoriously like were able to like win a ton of Oscars by doing aggressive campaigns. But like, how absolutely necessary is it for a movie to put in an aggressive campaign to get nominated? And does that have any effect on whether or not it wins?
So there's two sides to this. One is that I think it is wildly important. People might not like to admit that, but and a lot of it is people at the end of the day, Oscar voters are going to vote for what they want. Yeah. Like we've seen that with Green Book when everyone was saying like, you know, don't vote for Green Book. I was like, they like Green Book. That's what they're going to vote for. At the same time, getting people to see the movie. Like I remember all season, I was like, if people just see NIAID, it's really hard not to cast a vote for Annette Bening for a nomination, you know, and people were kind of surprised that she kept popping up there, but they campaigned really hard. They got her out there in front of events. You make people go to see that movie. And I had this experience over and over again with audiences where they were like, I didn't know it would be so funny. I didn't know it'd be so inspiring. I didn't expect to laugh and cheer and cry, you know? So a lot of it is just like, there's something like, people like kind of shy away from campaigning like it's an ugly thing to do. But like if you worked really hard on a movie and put your life and soul and money into it, wouldn't you want people to see it?
Well, and if you're making a movie like NIAID too, like it's because you think the story is important.
Exactly. You just want to get it in front of people. Yeah. So like campaigning can be kind of like, you know, a sensitive word, but it's like you're saying like, no, please come check this out. You know, and then the rest is up to y'all. But like it makes a big difference getting people out, getting people to like host a screening. You know, I went to a screening actually, I think it was of NIAID that Jared Leto hosted.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it was like, you know, I don't know if some people came just because Jared was hosting or something like that. But like getting those people in those seats, you know, even at a bunch of small screenings, having people work the room. I always think back, there's a couple examples. The first one that springs to mind is the year I realized Jean Dujardin was going to win Best Actor because I watched him work that room, you know, and he was so, and people also loved the artist, but there, like everybody thought it was Clooney's year for The Descendants. And I remember like sitting there, there was like an actual point in a Q&A where it had been over for like an hour and a half and he was still there talking to people. And I was like, this guy could win, you know? Now, ultimately, people had to see the performance and they fell in love with it. And that's probably why they voted for him, but it made a huge difference. And it's not just about showing up, you know, don't want to name names, but there's one actor who seemed to be a front runner to win an Oscar and he showed up, but wasn't pleasant to people, you know? Yeah. And then I watched that slip away. So it's like, show up, be on, it's work, it's part of a performance.
And who are the people, I mean, like the people who are voting in the Academy are all Academy members, but they're all people within the same category, right?
So it's no, not necessarily. It's just, these things are just usually open to Academy members in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then a lot of times I do a lot for SAG and those are actors.
Yeah.
And it's a big voting body.
Well, each of the unions and the guilds that, you know, so there's the SAG Awards, the DGA Awards, the ASC Awards, yada, yada.
Yeah.
I mean, they all have their own.
SAG Awards are so key for actors. And they start with like a group of people who are chosen every year, like I think it's 1,200, maybe 1,500. And those are the people who decide who what the nominations will be.
Mm-hmm.
So those people get courted really aggressively. But everyone is courting them. So again, your movie has to hold up. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
matter if you give them a big fancy dinner and, you know, invite them to, you know, shake hands with the stars if the movie isn't good.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like that's why Oppenheimer, I think also people are just circling Oppenheimer because it really, you know, it resonated with people. Like, weirdly, it came out in the middle of the summer and was a big summer hit and it looks amazing. And I also, and from a cinematography standpoint, you know, the innovations that they had to create to make that movie
literally
work.
Creating new technologies.
Yeah.
And then like some of the stuff I didn't even realize. I was you know, I'm not aware of it while I'm sitting there that like, an IMAX movie has never run more than 3 hours because the platters are too big, you know? But then you learn that and you're like, they literally had to create a new, they'd never shot black and white.
Yeah, they had to create a whole stuff.
Yeah.
And when we talked to Hoyta about that, you know, to me, like the part that if I had thought about it for 15 seconds, I was like, of course, but he was like, it wasn't just about getting Kodak to create that. We also had to get Photochem to create a workflow for processing it because they don't have that many tanks to do that.
And I never would have thought of any of that. I'm just sitting there going, ooh, this movie looks pretty.
Yeah.
But that's the intention. Really, yes. you know, it's only like super cinema nerds, like the people in this room who go to the movie theater, who then might even find themselves, you know, checking out for a second going like, how the hell did they do that? Yeah. What's the story behind that?
But do we feel like right now we're in an era though, where like the IMAXification of cinemas is kind of driving the economy of the business? You know, like when you look at the percentage of the money that Oppenheimer made, or as we sit here, Dune Part 2 opened last weekend and it had a huge weekend, but I want to say I read that it was like 43% of its revenue came from IMAX screenings.
They get to charge a lot more money for it. IMAX, and that's a premium. It's a premium experience. You get to, the more money comes in per seat. So,
have you ever done 4D?
Yes.
A friend of mine accidentally got tickets to a 4D showing of Dune and like walked out 10 minutes in and was like, hey, I'm really sorry. And they're like, oh, did you get 4D tickets on accident? Yeah, we'll set you up with a regular screening.
Yeah.
Because it's on the sides as well.
Yeah. That's a little weird.
I don't think I'd like that. That's Soylent Green.
Yeah. Also, I'm thinking of 4DX, the one where you sit in the seat that shakes you around and it's like supposed to be more immersive and like nothing.
Who needs that?
Nothing reminds me that I'm in a movie theater more than being afraid I'm going to be thrown out of my chair.
I watched a movie on my phone on a plane yesterday, maybe 2 days ago, and it held up because it was a good movie.
Yeah.
You know, that's all it takes.
But to me, that's what's interesting about it is that, you know, like the average moviegoer might be excited to see something in IMAX, but like what does the average moviegoer know about the technology with IMAX? Like, for instance, Dune Part 2 was shot digitally and released in IMAX, and I'm sure that it's making the most of the use of IMAX, but, you know, the whole Christopher Nolan argument is that they're making it all photochemically, so it's old school.
It's interesting because one of the movies that people who don't really know much about cinematography or care about that stuff cite a lot this season has been The Holdovers. Because even they recognize, wow, that looks like a movie that was made in the 70s.
So much.
You know, how did they do that? And how did they put the pops and the crackles and the lines? And it's very interesting to me that, like, people notice that.
Such a great movie and totally deserving of recognition.
By the way, one of those movies that I actually think I enjoyed more at home than in the theater. I feel bad saying that because everyone should go to the theater.
For sure.
But it's just, it's such a... I know outsider Pete doesn't like that word. I say cottagecore. And actually, I don't think it's cozy. I think it's kind of cold.
Yeah.
But it's like, but it is something that, like, you know, you...
Well, I think that seeing the outside, seeing the cold world and then, you know...
Yes, it makes you want to,
But you're right. It is a little bit of a cold movie. And
it is. All those shots of snow and, like, the character is very unlikable for a large portion of the movie. Like,
for sure.
Yeah.
I keep saying that I feel like it's almost like an unofficial sequel to Election because Tracy Flick was going to end up like that guy. Like Tracy Flick in her 50s is going to be someone who's like completely disillusioned and had been like a hyped up overachiever for nothing.
I think Tracy Flick is running the world at this point.
Maybe.
So. By the way, I recently watched, I was telling Alexander Payne this because for some reason, HBO was showing Election a lot in the last few months. And so I ended up like watching it actually a couple of times. And at the first junket for The Holdovers, I was telling him that. And he was like, how does it hold up? And I was like, honestly, like ahead of its time. Like, I don't think I realized when I watched it, like when I first saw it, I'm sure I thought Tracy Flick was a bitch.
Yeah.
You know, and watching it now, I'm like, the movie never thought that. The movie knew, you know, who... You know, what was going on. And when I watched it again, I was like, oh, man, this movie is so smart. And it was so ahead of its time in terms of like recognizing these, you know, this toxic masculinity. Like she's really like her high school teacher groomed her. Like we kind of laugh about it because there are some very funny moments in the movie where he's like, you know, we're in love. And but like that movie really knew what it was doing. And, you know, they had an alternate ending originally.
They did?
Yes. Where she like basically comes and buys a car from the Matthew Broderick character. And she kind of like you can find it online.
Oh, they filmed it.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. Yeah. No, it was, I think it was, they did the other one as a reshoot. And I'm really glad they didn't go with it because it almost felt like they were apologizing to Matthew Broderick and like there was like this softness about her where she was like scared about the future. And I love seeing her succeeding and achieving at the end. And he still doesn't get that he was the bad guy in this scenario.
Matthew Broderick's so good in that movie.
So good.
It's such a great role for him.
I would actually say that The Holdovers and Election are probably my two favorite Alexander Payne movies. Like I think they're both.
I weirdly love About Schmidt. That movie like broke me. Like, I remember we saw it together.
I need to see it again.
Well, remember it was flat when they first started showing, when they had to leave
They had the lens wrong, and I actually went to the manager, and I'm like, I used to be a projectionist. I can fix this in 10 seconds. They're like, we can't let you in the booth. Yeah. And I'm like,
Arr. Here's my union card.
It was never a union.
Yes, so we had to come back like 2 hours later or something. Yeah, and I love The Descendants because Kauai.
If I'm going to go with cinematography for Alexander Payne movies, I got to give it to Nebraska. I think the black and white is gorgeous. And I got to mention another similarity here. All of the nominees this year all have at least some black and white in them. Yeah. So they're black and white is definitely sort of the classic.
That's why Barbie didn't belong.
Yeah.
Or Holdovers.
Should have released the black and chrome version of Barbie.
Barbie black and chrome.
I bet it looks amazing.
I got to say, before Dune, I just saw Dune. Before that, they'd had the Furiosa trailer. Mm. And I got to say, I've now seen the Furiosa trailer like 3 times. It doesn't look like it's even from the same world as, it looks like it's from a completely different world than Fury Road. It looks like a video game a little bit. The colors are
It looks like it might have either been filmed in a volume or green screen or something. I'm not sure. I mean, like, I don't know.
And I'm withholding all judgment till I see it. Of course.
George Miller is a genius, and I will trust him.
I'm not like, you know, dismissing anything based on the trailer, but that look in the trailer, it is a lot of look. It is a different, it's a different
it's
sort of
colorful,
vibe.
Very colorful, I'll say that.
And it's completely different vibe. It looks like the future, not the past, so to speak, if I'm imagining what the post-apocalyptic world of, you know, the latest Fury Roads or Road
Warriors
are.
Well, none of this matters, because if we want to talk the 2025 Oscars, it's Dune 2. So we're working already. You know, it's funny because when people started like talking about Oppenheimer in July and how it was going to sweep the Oscars, I was like, we got a long road ahead of us.
For real.
I've been resisting that at every turn, and it was the SAG Awards where I was like, okay, it's done.
But can I say, I feel like 2023, maybe I'm speaking ahead of myself here, but I feel like it's going to go down as one of the better movie
years.
It's
a really good year.
Like, solid stuff.
There's no movie in the 10 nominees. There's one that I was not personally a fan of, but there's none that I think are bad.
Yeah.
Or even like mediocre, I would say.
Well, and that's how I feel about the cinematography category, especially, is it's like, you know, I have my movies that I had a better experience seeing that could have to do with the day that I was having when I saw them or whatever. But like all 5 of them are amazing. But I always want to ask the question, not to say which one would you knock out of this, but which other films will go around? Like, which other films do you think should have been in there? Because we had some great looking movies like Napoleon, The Killer, Barbie.
Past Lives I just wish it had done better across the board. And I'm thrilled that it got a screenplay and a Best Picture nomination. But that movie was like on another level for me.
American Fiction. American Fiction was so movie. And for me, it was like they did such an incredible job with making a comedy look like an incredible comedy and add these little nuances. There's so many nuances in the cinematography of that movie. I loved it.
All right, I'm going to say something controversial. Wonka.
Didn't see it.
Wonka's great.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's Wonka, I mean, you know, it might be the comedy bias, but
it looked beautiful.
It looks great. And just like Paddington 2.
I was just going
like,
to say.
I triple dog dare you not to enjoy freaking Wonka. Like, you know, I'm not someone who you would meet and be like, I bet you're a big fan of Wonka.
No, you were actually surprised you liked it. I was super surprised.
I saw it over the holidays and it was like, you know, like trying to find something I could show to my 5-year-old son that would be appropriate out of all the Oscar screeners that I had. And I was like, Wonka should be okay. And we were all just totally in the whole way. And
I tried to watch it last night, but I thought, because they have it like teased on HBO Max, or sorry, just Max.
Max.
And, but it was actually just the trailer for it. And I was so mad because I'm actually really excited to see it.
Mad Max.
Yeah.
Hugh Grant steals everything.
That's the thing too. Like when I saw those trailers, I was like, what is Hugh Grant doing? And by all accounts, he's the best part of it.
Holy crap. He's so good.
He's so funny. He's so funny. I just love the jaded Oompa Loompa. Reminds me of, The Simpsons.
Yeah.
There's a joke about they went to the factory and they're like, did you see any Oompa Loompas? And I'm like, just one, but he looked very sad. And it's like, you kind of like see this jaded Oompa Loompa smoking. That's how I imagine Hugh Grant. You know, something about American Fiction that I really love, though, and I don't know if I can articulate this because I'm very hungry, but it's something that Robbie Ryan... They all do a great job of this. Is obviously part of the job, but like letting those performances shine.
Oh yeah,
like Robbie Ryan. The thing about Poor Things is how each character and each actor has their moment and their look and their, you know, there's something really special about it. And that's not to say that the other cinematographers don't do that, but I just think it's such a special, that's also why I like Past Lives.
Well, one of the things about Poor Things, when we were talking to him, I'll always remember, is that he would light it so the actors could kind of do whatever they were going to do.
Yep.
Actors might be acting in a literal forest of C-stands and cutters and having to hit really precise marks. And you think about like what Emma Stone had to do in Poor Things. And it's like, if she had to do that while being like, oh, if I'm 1 inch closer, I'll be out of focus. Obviously, when you're on that kind of a wide angle lens, you're never going to be out of focus. But, you know, some of that stuff, like to me, it's what makes it so magical is that it almost feels like theater, like the best things about theater and the best things about film all
there's
at once.
There's an intimacy there. But at the same time, I have to get credit to somebody like Cillian Murphy, who has a giant loud camera.
Yeah, it sounds like a VW bus in your face.
Revving in his ear while he's trying to do like this, you know, intense scenes.
I rewatched, because I think I've seen Oppenheimer 3 times now. I saw it in 70 millimeter, and then I saw it again, like I watched it twice.
Came out with like a beard. I didn't have this beard before.
I was 12 when I started. No, but like his performance really is just next level. And I do feel like, and you know, Hoyta talked about that a lot, about like, you know, setting that IMAX camera up and getting basically like a large format photograph of him, like just the intensity of that photograph and how much more of the performance goes through it. And I feel like so much credit has to go to everyone too, like from, again, to go back to that Q&A that you did, it's like the makeup people, as a former makeup artist, like when you were shooting on film or digital, you know, it's like if I was this close to someone and I saw a little edge on a prosthetic, you wouldn't always worry about it. But on IMAX, it sees the freaking world. Like you can't get away with any shenanigans. And you also know there's not going to be a digital cleanup of it. So you got to get it right the first time.
Remember how surprised I was that there were so many wigs? Because it looked so good.
You buy it.
I was
it.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it, the first time I saw it was before your Q&A, and then I saw it when it was released on Peacock after your Q&A. And that was when I was like really paying attention to all of these little minute details that have just been sweated all over. At random, by the way, I found out I went to college with the prop master on that.
Oh, no way.
Guillaume Delouche. I'm sure he's not listening to this, but
but if you are.
Props to you.
Hey!
Guillaume. No one's ever said that to Guillaume. I'm ashamed of myself.
I'm really thrilled that Robert Downey Jr. is like finally going to be an Oscar winner.
Yeah.
He really should have won for Chaplin. Which is not a great movie, but a great performance.
I like Chaplin, okay.
But let's delve into this a little bit. Okay, so is there any other shoo-ins? I mean, Robert Downey Jr., you think is a shoo-in?
Joy Randolph is going to win for The Holdovers, which honestly, I mean, I'm thrilled about as someone who thinks she should have won for Dolomite Is My Name, but did not see that sweep coming. When I saw The Holdovers, I was like, oh, this movie is so charming and lovely and I really like it. And it'll probably get a lot of nominations, but I don't know if it'll win anything. And the fact that it's done so well this season and she has just steamrolled, you know, over everyone, it's been like...
Now, again, is that about a campaign? Is that about her? Is that about just people loving that character?
It's the people loving the character, loving the movie, her being brilliant, the discovery, that, or, you know, even though she's been on Broadway and, only Murders
not,
in the Building.
She's not exactly new.
Yeah, but a lot of people have never seen her before. And then the fact that she is who she is and she goes out and charms people's pants off. Mm-hmm. At these events. Like, you know, it doesn't, you know, there are some people who don't campaign and they still win. You know, but like it definitely doesn't hurt.
There's always these movies that are kind of dark horses. I mean, like in our category, El Conde, a movie that I don't know that there was any Oscar push for El Conde. Certainly none that we were getting pushed on. And then it gets nominated for, you know, Best Cinematography. And it is a freaking masterpiece. And
if you see it, you understand why.
Oh, God.
It's just getting people to see it.
And it's the easiest thing to get people to see. I've been telling people about it ever since I saw it. Because it's like, if you have Netflix... Watch that tonight. It's awesome. You will be entertained.
You just have to say, like, President Vampire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Anything that you loved this year, that you really, really loved, that didn't get any recognition whatsoever?
I actually really, I really enjoyed Saltburn, and I wish Barry Keoghan would get, but I mean, he's going to be fine.
You know, I was going to say The Killer, but...
Oh, I love The Killer. Yeah, The Killer was really, love The Killer. Yeah. I did not expect, I actually, weirdly... was surprised by how much I like Nick Scholwins. I found it to be really charming. I don't know if I thought it deserved nominations, but I just want Michael Fassbender to do more comedies and be recognized for that.
But I'm actually glad you said Saltburn too, because that was another one, you know, where
we talked to Lena Sondgren.
Polarizing movie.
Such a great though.
I thought it would be more polarizing.
It's pretty.
Also, I don't think it's as, you know, it's interesting when people are like, oh, it's so shocking, I can't believe I did that. I'm like, do you watch Euphoria? Like nothing in the movie really shocked me.
I get where it's going, but to me it's like a movie of like, how's he gonna pull it off?
Right, that's what you. It's, you know, it's not a who done it. It's a why done it, or will it work? Yeah.
I think that for some people it doesn't work though. I've talked to people like they understand what's going on. It's just like it's not working. It's not clutching of pearls. It's like
this is not necessarily untrue, but I remember somebody saying like, "Hey, remember at the end when they do that like reveal of everything that happened that you've already actually seen?" And it's like, well, yeah, there isn't really a mystery, but that's not why I like it, you know?
No, but the performance really did drive that. And I sometimes wonder, too, because the director had done Promising Young Woman, which is a great film.
Masterpiece. And
Dynamite.
You know, like, was a big Oscar contender. And so, like, I feel like when you do that, suddenly you're thrust into that world where every movie you make has the pressure of gotta win an Oscar. And I kind of miss a time that wasn't that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, where like just a challenging drama like Saltburn could come out and doesn't need to win Oscars, but we can just go enjoy it as a freaking movie for grownups.
The one that really broke my heart was May December.
Mm.
I loved May December, and I knew it would be a bit of a trickier sell because it's such a weird tone. And like, you know, and like the levels that all those actors are working on is so insane to me. And it's really, really funny. I'm thrilled it got a screenplay nomination. But
do you think it just missed being zeitgeisty? Or?
I think some people felt that they were, I don't want to say offended, but they were like, they felt a little too seen, you know, when in the acting world. Like, I don't want to say they were making fun of actors, because they weren't. They were presenting what it's like, and it made some people uncomfortable. I also think at the end of the day, it's those acting races were so damn competitive. Like, I thought Natalie Portman was brilliant, but I always knew it would be hard for her to break. I mean, look, Greta Lee didn't get nominated. Yeah. Margot Robbie didn't get nominated. Like, it was just a bloodbath.
Such a great year, though.
Charles Melton, you know, if anything, I thought he would get through. I'm also surprised Dominic Sessa didn't get through, so.
It was an embarrassment of great performances this
really
year.
Really was. There was always going to be some... Yeah. Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
Freaking fantastic. But like at the end of the day, it is that like, who do you take out? You know?
Yeah. In the popularity contest of nominations, it's.
But that also kind of like circles back to Margot Robbie, which I do think it was surprising that she wasn't nominated just because, you know, I remember a year ago when she was not even the lead, but she was in two movies, Amsterdam and Babylon, and both of them underperformed. And I remember hearing some think piece on the radio or something where they were like, is Margot Robbie not a bankable star? And I'm like, go fuck yourself with that.
In a good movie, she is, yeah.
I actually really like Babylon. I understand it's a polarizing movie. It's a challenge. It's long. All of these movies are long. Like, the movies are just getting longer, especially the prestige movies. But, like, it wasn't anything she was doing wrong, you know?
No, and by the way, she's brilliant in Barbie. And if comedy's got more appreciation, especially in lead actor categories, I feel like in the supporting categories, comedies have a better shot. Like,
it's true.
What she is doing in that movie on so many levels is phenomenal. But
it's not an easy performance.
No. Literally, who else could have played that role?
Yeah.
Literally. And so, but I also recognize that there's five fantastic freaking actresses in that.
Yeah.
And the fact that Barbie got as far as it did is a miracle.
Also, I think all the people who made it they're going to be just fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no one's crying for Gosling.
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to throw out a Best Picture win? Are we all in agreement? Is Oppenheimer sweeping?
Oppenheimer was nothing even close to second.
Yeah, I think we're looking at an Oppenheimer sweep, and I will be personally shocked if it isn't. But also, all the movies that it's up against are all freaking great. So, you know, like,
there isn't one of the films that's there nominated.
It's not a Moonlight, La La Land sort of thing happening again this year. It's not going to be a surprise, a twist.
I mean, there's always some kind of surprise, though. Like, I won't be shocked if... You know, like if we get halfway through the telecast and Oppenheimer hasn't won all the ones that we're thinking it will win.
I'm curious to see what happens in adapted screenplay, because I suspect it will be Oppenheimer. There's so much, you know, overwhelm. It's just become a juggernaut. But that category is stacked.
Yeah.
You know, it's American Fiction, Poor Things.
Yeah.
I think if there's an upset, it's that category, and I think it's probably American Fiction.
People love that movie.
Just because the conversations that I'm hear people having and how much love has been specifically about the screenplay for that. So I don't know.
I haven't read the Oppenheimer book, but like a lot of what these adaptations did so well is preserving sort of the spirit of the book or the original source material, and then, but like making it its own thing. So I'd probably be happy with any of them. But
I mean, the Oppenheimer adaptation, like I heard an interview with Christopher Nolan and one of the two guys who wrote American Prometheus, and apparently that book is a freaking brick. It's like a 800 page tome about where they interview everyone who ever knew the guy. And so, you know, like the fact that he was able to find a through line.
Well, he also went out and found things independently that I think are fascinating. So yay, Christopher Nolan's finally going to be an Oscar winner.
Yeah, I mean, quite deserved. I mean, like, that's the thing, is everyone's, and especially in the cinematography category, like everyone who's nominated is someone that we've had on the show. We're huge fans of their work. We think that they're working at the top of their game. And so it's like, I do think it's obvious that Hoyta's probably going to win it and deserves to win it. But if there was an upset in that category, again, I'm not in any way crapping on All Quiet on the Western Front, but like, that was a shock. Mm-hmm. None of these would shock me.
Yeah.
If there was an upset, who would you want?
If there was an upset, I would definitely be in the Robbie Ryan Poor Things camp. Like I love everything. That movie is so my taste, and it's nothing against any of the other ones. Matty Lee Batik is one of my freaking heroes. Rodrigo Prieto is, you know, one of the greats. Ed Lockman did such a great job, and that guy's been shooting since his first credit is 1974. The Lords of Flatbush, a movie that we still see around today. I mean, like, all of these people are extraordinarily deserving. But I just think that Poor Things is a movie that, like, the whole movie kind of caught me off guard. And when we were talking to him too, it's like, it's cool that they were using IMAX for Oppenheimer and all that, but he brought back VistaVision for Poor Things. And that blew me away. Like, I didn't even know anyone was still talking about VistaVision. And it kind of set me down a rabbit hole of like, oh my God, yeah, you can still get VistaVision cameras. And
if there's an upset, I do think it'll be Robbie Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty amazing looking film, but I mean, they're all amazing looking, and I don't want to piss any of them off. I love them all.
Just vote El Conde to choose violence.
Yeah, always choose violence. I do love El Conde, and like, beautiful. 10 seconds into that movie, I was, Alicia and I were watching it, and I'm like, I love everything about this movie. And, you know, like, there was nothing I didn't love about that movie.
I guess I would go with Maddie.
That was going to be mine, but honestly, I'm just so happy with Hoyta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
I mean, Maddie deserves it, man. I mean, like, he's just been doing top notch work.
Should have won for Black Swan, probably.
Yeah. Hmm? Yeah. Black Swan.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
In fact, I thought he did. There was a moment where I was like, no, wait, didn't he win for that?
Yeah, Black Swan's pretty amazing. But I mean, like, he's been doing just top shelf work. Like, again, none of these people can you look at and go like, oh, that one's obviously the best cinematographer. It's mostly, I think, about like what material resonates the most with you as an individual viewer, which is so subjective.
Yeah, everything's subjective. It's also going to be how you feel about these movies, how you feel about any of this, the subject matter. It's like, when you get to the ASC, when you get to certain guilds or organizations, everyone is really, I want to say, myopic, and they're really picking out. And sometimes that's why you see some oddballs. You see some picks that are not part of like the mainstream.
Yeah.
But once it's in the mainstream, it's really difficult for some people to separate what it is that they're seeing versus it is the way that they're seeing something. And yeah. I think it's exactly the same thing that happens with best sound editing.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And it's like
that world gets so subjective that even if you're, you know, Randy Tom or something like that, you know, it's like, well, you're not going to do a better sound edit with lesser material, you know, like you've got to be given the material to work with. So to me, it's like Hoyte von Hoytema, I would have given him the Oscar for freaking Let the Right One In 2008. You know, like I love his work, you know, he's so good. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, it's like Maddie should win the Oscar.
He will someday. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah.
No doubt.
And also I feel like none of these guys, when we talk to them, feel like they are laser focused on even caring about whether they win the Oscar. Like they're working at the top of the craft. They're making some of them movies that textbooks are going to be written about, like to me, like that's they're making striking, beautiful images that are really moving us, and that's what they're here to do.
Didn't Roger Deakins like lose 13 times?
Yeah. So and then one for Blade Runner 2049.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, which is very deserving, by the way. But it's just like you know.
I've heard some people say that. A lot of people felt like it was time. And
it was. I would have given it to him for Barton Fink. I mean, you know.
Barton Fink.
I remember Jim Broadbent when he won for Best Supporting Actor for Iris. But yeah, you know, there was a lot of people who were saying he so was deserved for Moulin Rouge.
Yes.
And so there were people who were like, we should be.
Well, going back to Scorsese, I mean, he didn't win Best Director until The Departed. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that Goodfellas is an objectively better film.
No, it absolutely is.
It's just, yeah. No, I mean, like, how much do we talk about Dances with Wolves today versus Goodfellas?
Dances with Wolves holds up. I feel like I have to defend it.
It's a good film. Yeah. I'm not saying it's a bad
good
film.
Movie. Yeah.
No, there's great things about it. But, like, Goodfellas is one of those movies that, like, is, it's almost like it came out last year. It's so.
Modern classic. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny, I saw like one of those, you know, honest Oscar ballots, which, whatever. but like somebody was saying, you know, people don't understand like what film editing truly is. And like, we should give it to Thelma Schumacher because, you know, without her, that movie would have been 4 hours long. And I'm like, you don't understand what film editing is if that's what you think an editor is doing. Like, you just proved your point.
Yeah, was this on YouTube?
No, I try to avoid YouTube rabbit holes like that. Yeah.
I go down all of them.
It's tough. It's tough because, you know, everybody's an expert. Everybody's an expert. So,
but yeah. Really, we're just the experts. So, just us.
Factually true, the best movie of the year is Elemental.
Elemental's really good.
If you
really
ask my son, that's probably the one he would go with. We saw that in the theater and he wanted to go see it the next day. Aww. And we were like, that sounds like 2.5 hours. I don't have to chase you around a playground. And then we saw it in 4DX.
No. Oh, what a nightmare.
Yeah.
I got nothing else. You guys, is there another category or thing that we need to dive into? Or then I think we should probably wrap this up. Yeah,
me too. Yeah. No, but Janelle, thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
And if there's a giant upset, we should like do a quick Zoom and
you can just pelt things. We
gawk. We can all have whips and we can whip ourselves.
I have to shave my head.
No, thank you. And I will see you obviously before then, but we'll see you next year when Woo-hoo! We're talking Oscar stuff.
Yay! It was great.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.